You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
If this cold weather is getting you down, a new production of Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, starring Scarlett Johansson, Benjamin Walker, and Kieran Hines, is generating some heat at the Richard Rogers Theater on West 46th Street. It's on stage until March 30th, and I'm pleased to welcome to our show now Ben Walker, who plays Brick, and Kieran Hines, who's Big Daddy. Welcome.
Thank you.
How are you?
Ben, your last two big roles were Andrew Jackson in the musical Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln in the movie Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. Mm-hmm. Did you take this role because you were afraid you were being typecast as the guy who plays dead presidents?
Quirky dead presidents. Quirky interpretations. No, I took the part because Rob Ashford was directing it and I had these amazing actors to work with. I mean, even if the play had been bad, I would have given it a shot. And luckily it's not.
Well, it's one of the greatest plays. It was Williams's favorite of his own plays.
Right. What was the essay where he refers to it as a perfect play, which only Tennessee can do?
And do you think
does
it feel that way? Perfect? Because it has changed over the years.
Well, I will say that the more we work on it, the more we learn about it. I find that sometimes when you're working on a play, there's a point of plateau. And we have yet to reach that, and I don't actually see it in our future. There's a lot in there.
Yeah. It's a never-ending process, really, to get to the heart of it.
Well, some actors have told me that they sometimes are sad to see the play close because they're just getting
I know. Part. It's closing night. I just figured that out.
Yeah. Yeah. Karen, one critic wrote, "You won't believe Hines is Irish. So wonderfully does he capture a Southerner whose genteel facade dissolves." For many years, Hollywood would only cast British and Irish actors in Southern roles, like Vivian Leigh and Leslie Howard in Gone with the Wind. But that's changed.
Has it?
Well,
here I am again. I mean,
well, we're seeing more and more British actors just doing perfect American accents.
Yeah, no, that's true. There's a new generation of actors, I think, in American television as well, playing
Olivier had problems with it, but pretty much any of the young actresses don't seem to. You've played American characters before, like the one based on Bill Clinton in the TV miniseries Political Animals.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it does come as a surprise that you're asked to do it, but I don't know whatever the choice that people make, whether it's producers or directors seeing you, whatever you bring to the table. And then there's the dialect and accent to work on, but sometimes it does surprise me.
Well, but British actors are, and you are British because, or UK anyway, Northern Ireland, right?
Yeah.
They are.
Let's not go divide down that line about. I would consider myself Irish, but I suppose in that context I am, yeah.
Well, they have to play many different kinds of accents. Is it any more of a challenge to play an American than a British lord or someone from Scotland or Yorkshire or London's East End?
Actually, no. It's the same game to get to the heart of where the story is located and to be. But then when I thought I was asked over to do this, I'm wondering, like, I'm Irish and then I have to go into the Mississippi Delta. And then suddenly something clicked in. I said, well, I mean, for example, Ben is from Georgia and then people from Louisiana, Scarlett's from New York. We've all got to meet somewhere. And wherever we come from, even though you think, oh, but they're American, the diversity of American dialects is extraordinary. So we've all got to come and meet in the same place somewhere.
And Ben, although you're from Georgia, you don't normally speak with a Georgian accent. Did you have to unlearn it?
At school, they, I guess, beat it out of me in a good way. And it is kind of problematic because the accent that, say, my family uses is very different than a Mississippi accent, even though it is Southern.
And people would notice that? I mean,
certainly my mother would.
Because this is Mississippi.
Right. And it's also Mississippi in the 50s. As, you know, time progresses, these accents change, obviously. But I think that's right, that the poetry of the play lends itself to a specific dialect. And then we had a wonderful dialect coach, Deb Hecht. And like Kieran said, we are just trying to meet in one place where we all agree.
Did you do this play at Juilliard?
I didn't. No.
Why not?
they wouldn't have me.
It wasn't on the menu.
No, I guess not.
But often when actors do their auditions, they do something from Tennessee Williams.
No, I hadn't. I was doing House of Blue Leaves and things like that.
You have other challenges to contend with in this, like wearing a cast on one foot, using a crutch, and hobbling around on a rake stage because Brooke has a broken ankle. Have you ever had a broken ankle?
I haven't. And it is a strangely problematic. And there's a lot of fighting and rolling around and
it's very
swinging
physical.
Crutches.
You fall to the floor a number of times.
Well, you know, when you drink that much, that's what happens. But with the rake and the crutch, if you're facing one way, the crutch is too long. If you're facing another way, it's too short. But that setup really lends itself nicely to being drunk because you always feel like you're about to fall over. So kind of does half the work for you.
And if you're not about to fall over, you're given help falling over because it might beat the crap out of you.
Right, exactly.
But Karen, you're not drunk, and you still have to deal with that rake.
Yeah, it's very interesting because they did in rehearsal, which is quite a... I don't know if they do it normally, but they built a rake in the rehearsal room so that people could get used to where the body positions and stuff. But when I was very early, was much younger, I worked at a theatre, the Glasgow Citizens Theatre, in Glasgow in Scotland, and they often used rakes quite steep. So maybe I've got this swayed back that might just absolutely a rake is the perfect place for me. I don't know.
He stumbles on the sidewalk, but on a rake.
Yeah, terrible at just walking along the road.
You play father and son. Did you have to work things out in rehearsal to make that relationship come across as believable?
I don't think so. I think I won't speak for you, but I feel like we've really just hit it off naturally.
I agree entirely.
So there is no physical cues that you might pick up, the common mannerisms to suggest that you come out of the same family?
Well, there was one thing. I don't know if you've noticed or care, but Kieran has long hair. So they allowed me to grow my hair long, and he does this thing with his hair. He pushes his hair back that I find very attractive in him, so I try and do it just... Well, I don't know that it enriches the story, but I think it's dashing, so I'm stealing it.
But you probably would have had a crew cut at the time.
I know, exactly. But with Brick, I think that these two men, in particular in this society, are kind of an anomaly in how they've existed and how things have come to them. And so I think it works well that Brick is a little out of the form of what we would expect from a quarterback at that time.
My guests are Benjamin Walker and Karen Hines, who are currently appearing in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, also starring Scarlett Johansson, Deborah Monk, and Emily Burgle, and a number of other important actors. It's at the Richard Rogers Theater on West 46th Street. A limited run because you all have other projects to go to?
I assume so. I mean,
Assume so? You don't know what you're doing after this?
No, I'm doing a pilot, but it wouldn't stop us from doing the play.
I think Scarlett's going off to do
Captain America or something.
Yeah, I mean, she has previous commitments, I think, that were arranged a long time ago, so that's why it's a limited run.
The play has been staged so many times by my count. It's the third Broadway production in just the last 10 years. Did Rob Ashford, the director, have a particular reason for wanting to do this play now? Is this like Shakespeare, where we could have two Macbeths in New York at the same time?
Or three. Mm-hmm. I mean, which goes on a lot.
Does the play have that much in it that you can find different things?
I definitely think so. And I think one of the things that drew Rob to it, in spite of it having had a few incarnations, is that he wanted to do something different in terms of bringing these characters down from their pedestals. It's not Kieran doing a Big Daddy or me doing a Brick. We're just doing the play as almost like a family drama, like an August Osage County almost.
Well, are you suggesting that other people do it as a Brick? There's almost like a
absolutely
quintessential...
Well, sure.
Well, I can't speak for that because I've never seen the play. And of course,
not at all. You never saw the film either?
No, I saw it in the 60s at some stage. I might have been
Paul Newman and Burl Ives had your parts.
Paul Newman in blue pajamas and baby blue eyes. Mm-hmm. That beautiful actor. Yeah.
Now it's all mud eyes over here.
Yeah, it's dark brown sludge. But I think it's when you approach anything, whatever influences are on us as artists, as actors, as laborers with words, it has to come from our soul. And I think Rob's idea, when he said about what he wanted to make from this work, was a sort of an earthiness, rather than the idea of, well, these characterizations should be played this way or they're normally done that way. It's whatever you bring in your soul to interpret freely between us what we create as a family, but to create something just from the words and ignore the rest of it and see where we go.
But there is, I imagine, a temptation to play these characters as larger than life because they are, your character, especially Big Daddy, is dealt with by all the people around him as an outsized character, and he sees himself as somebody who's really big and important.
Yeah, well, that's got to do with, I suppose, wealth and power, like anything, and then people become, in a way, I think it's the question of, do you make them grotesque, or do you look for the humanity inside the bigness of them? And I think that's what Rob wanted from everybody, was some kind of truth, some kind of rawness that hurt, the pain, using Tennessee Williams' natural poetry to allow that out, but with a truthfulness that then drags the family all together with important issues at stake.
And what about that natural poetry? You have to say those lines as though they aren't beautifully written, don't you?
Well, I mean, you do, but that's helped by the fact that you're saying them to someone like Kieran, and what you're trying to do with that poetry to him, or trying to communicate through the poetry, that they're not, in much the same way the Shakespearean characters are not conscious that they speak in this way. This is just how it happens to come out.
Well, they keep repeating that the plantation is 28,000 acres of the richest land this side of the Nile.
Mm-hmm.
This side of the Valley.
Valley Nile, yeah.
The Valley.
Yeah, that's mentioned on more than four occasions, mm-hmm. or five. Yeah,
it's set in the 1950s, and some of the attitudes of that time, like those towards homosexuality, seem a bit outdated now. How did you make it feel relevant to today's audiences?
I don't know. I guess I hadn't really thought of it that way, but I don't know. I think this homosexuality and love and the communication of love and sexuality is something we're certainly all still dealing with in a large capacity. I don't know that it's as outdated as we'd like to think, maybe just because we live in New York.
Well, or sexual identity, a sense of sexual identity. Yeah. Williams said that he thought, probably would have been upset that so many people see this as that kind of latent homosexual play, when he thought Brick was straight.
I do think it's more complicated than...
Yeah, just straight, you know, or gay or whatever. Yeah. It's about... there is such a thing as deep, deep platonic love, but on the other side, from one of the parties, it could want to develop into a physical love. And then, but, you know, that connection takes two people to agree to it.
Right. And it's less about figuring out which box it fits into and more about living in the confusion of what that is and what that means to the family and what that means to your own self-identity, that's where the play lives. And I think what people struggle with when they see the play, if they have an expectation, is that they expect it to have an answer at the end. And I think if you do that, you've robbed Tennessee of something that's really great about something that he's written.
Well, Williams scholars say Williams always insisted that Brick was heterosexual. But I guess it's like so many things. Everything is open to interpretation. You can play Richard III as a misunderstood man or as a total villain, right?
Yeah, and nothing is 100% sure in our lives as we go, or our opinions or our tastes or whatever. We contradict ourselves. Our heart sometimes seems to betray what our mind does. And in that respect, Williams just puts it all out there and say it's not a, what do you call it, The boxes aren't all ticked, and this is what I expect an audience to glean from it. They've just seen a family go to war. Mm-hmm. I mean, war, and the stakes are so high, and it does involve power and money and sex. But it's sort of gloriously, painfully beautiful at the same time. And these are issues that involve us all. So that's why, in a way, it's a classic timeless piece.
My guests are Kieran Hines and Benjamin Walker, two of the stars of a new production of Tennessee Williams' classic Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. It's at the Richard Rogers Theater on West 46th Street. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Here we go. We are back with Benjamin Walker and Karen Hines, who play Brick and Big Daddy in new production of Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, currently at the Richard Rogers Theater, the huge Richard Rogers Theater on West 46th Street.
Yes. Well, it's the biggest theater I've ever played in.
Really?
Yeah.
I was just amazed at how large that stage is, and I was thinking, well, that has to be a workout as well on a raked floor.
It's a beast.
Yeah, it is. When the going gets hot, there's a lot of energy expended. And because the set, which is an extraordinary set, I mean, even from the perspective of being on it, with those giant doors and drapes, and it's open, so also it's not closed going out, so there's a lot of energy needed to project and share the dialogue with the audience.
I've looked at some of the previous casts, and it's interesting to imagine how Ben Gazzara as Brick and Burl Ives as Big Daddy did the roles that you do. Burl Ives, as we said, was also with Paul Newman in the film version. Then there was Keir DeLay and Fred Gwynne.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Jason Patrick and Ned Beatty. Right. People may remember that. That wasn't all that long ago. And then Terrence Howard and James Earl Jones. You haven't seen any of those productions?
I haven't. And I think it's helped us. It's allowed us to keep it fresh and to not, because people come in with so much expectation, for us not to have it, it quickly dissolves, we hope.
Yeah. And it's interesting, excuse me, when people decide, oh, that's not the way to play it. As soon as anybody says that's not the way to play it, you go like, well, what is the way to play it? The way the first guy did it, or what's laid down, or whatever. But classical pieces are always open to interpretations.
And I've always wondered about that when I read reviews, where it's obvious that the reviewer has an ideal production, and these people did not live up to that.
You don't even get anywhere near it, and it's just a big cross slap from the first paragraph. This is wrong. And now, you go, it's like as if the play doesn't exist suddenly. Mm-hmm. And he hasn't, whoever they are, whoever it may be, writing about it, it's their informed opinion and their taste. But it's kind of strange, because the more you see, the more attitude you have to something. And it's very hard to come in and just say, just can you see afresh, look different. And it may not be up to the standard or whatever, that's okay. But it sort of did get, some things get tarred just from, this is the fifth one I've seen and it's still not up to it.
Now, this play has several versions. Ilya Kazan, who directed the first Broadway production in 1955, insisted that Williams revise it substantially. And then he revised it again in 1974, putting back some of the cuts that Kazan had insisted on. Do you know which script you're working from?
I think we're working from the greatest hits. compiled. Because, yeah. And there were a bunch of different versions also in the beginning. I mean, there's one in which Big Daddy tries to kill everybody at the end with the bow and arrow. He's shooting them on the gallery.
I never read that bit, but I heard about it. Yeah. It starts picking them off. And then, I think Tennessee Williams, the original one, Big Daddy doesn't come back in the third act.
Right, he doesn't.
He's just gone. Kazan insisted on that. And then when Williams revised it again, he realized that Kazan was right on that. Kazan's big complaint in the original version was that Maggie was just not likable enough. He wanted him to soften it to some degree.
Well, we don't have that problem on this version.
No, because it's Maggie's wounded.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
desperate. She's in a desperate state. And to play that, but play it with truth and need and being lost, and the man you love is just called a blank on you. And yet, a Big Daddy recognizes in her something true, as opposed to the charades of people performing all around him. And that's sort of the connection he makes. And he also, the Big Daddy, he says at one stage that the only thing I ever cared about was you, not his wife, not the other son, not anything, just the land and Brick.
Mm-hmm. But he seems to prefer Brick and Maggie to everybody else.
And why is that?
Even though everybody else does everything possible to please him.
Yeah, and are probably overall better behaved.
Wait a minute.
But you can't help your heart. Yeah.
The play consists of three acts. It's been described in musical terms as a solo, then a duet, and then an ensemble.
Sure, it's like a ballet almost.
Yeah, it does seem to fit that pattern, doesn't it? Although I would disagree with the idea of the solo, just because...
Well, Maggie does have
has all the dialogue, yeah. But it also needs a board to
bounce it off.
Bounce it off. That board over there.
Yeah, it's a piece of wood.
Yeah.
Well, you play to some degree as a piece of, not exactly a piece of wood, but you are non-responsive in the first act. And then we see a whole different brick in the second act where you and Big Daddy are
finally communicating.
Well, yeah, communicating and dealing with some of the big issues of this current situation.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is the trouble with Brick, to have active inactivity, to be in a scene with your wife and communicate with her while not having any dialogue. And that's the trouble of it and also the beauty of it.
You are wearing only a towel during much of that scene, and then
yeah.
you have to change into pajamas with a cast on your foot.
Yeah.
And then you have to get around the room in a crutch while continually drinking and refilling your glass. Are you actually drinking?
No.
I don't mean alcohol. I mean,
absolutely, yeah. If we didn't have two intermissions, I'd be in a real bind.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
So did all of that physical business require some careful choreography?
Yes and no. We choreographed enough to make it safe, but at the same time, we all have such a physical facility that I think it can ebb and flow as the scene ebbs.
Well, haven't you hurt yourself?
Well, that was a snap. We had a rug that wasn't attached to the floor entirely, and I broke a toe. But, you know, that's good
apart
for me.
From that.
Other than that.
All the time you hit me with the bottle.
Well, you were a little close to where I was throwing it.
I was in the wrong place.
I read
those are the good things.
Those are the good things.
Keeps
you
it
see
alive.
The state of Ben's arms? Because he falls over so many times. And if he's not falling over, he's throwing around the place. So basically, it's like a kid cuts, bruises, grazes, just all
and
over.
Wearing white pajamas.
I know. I do get a lot of flack for bleeding on my pajamas. But
I read that the producers installed a pull-up bar in your dressing room.
Yeah.
Because you needed to have a more muscular physique.
Well, I think that...
Why didn't I get one of those? Sorry.
Slim Daddy.
Well, they're going to give you a treadmill.
Yeah. Well, I definitely think that that's one of the joys of being an actor is you get to change and augment your instrument. You get to genuinely change your physique to match someone you're trying to create. That's part of the fun of it. And if that means I got to do some pull-ups, I'm happy to do it.
My guests are Benjamin Walker and Karen Hines. Both starring in a new production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, currently at the Richard Rogers Theater on West 46th Street. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the second act, Big Daddy's trying to find out what's going on with Brick, who has fallen into this alcoholic funk after the death of his best friend, Skipper. Do you think when you work that out for yourself, Karen, do you think that he knows he's really dying and doesn't want to leave the plantation to his son, Gooper, so he wants to – he's hoping that Brick will straighten things out?
I think in the – just the backdrop of the play, that he's been in a state of almost immobility because he knows there's something wrong and they're waiting for the news of how bad it is. But I think like many things in life, certainly as men especially, I think when it comes to medical things, can be in denial. Mm-hmm. Or there's something wrong.
Well, everybody's in denial
but
here.
It will be, yeah. I mean, whether it's mentally or physically. But this idea of him saying, believing finally that he's clear because a report comes from the hospital or he's told it, is also sort of self lying to oneself as opposed to other people lying to the others. But this is the crisis day is he's been through something. He's been in a state of... immobility, and he's been not talking. He's been lost in this, I suppose we talk about mortality and what it means. And suddenly he gets this supposedly idea of, like, you're free, you can go on. And at that point, I think he realized, I've got to talk to this boy of mine. I've got to sort him out. I don't know where he is, because he doesn't even realize that he's as alcoholic as he is. He thinks he's drinking too much. But the step between drinking too much and being alcoholic is major.
But he also seems to be more concerned with Brick's alcoholism than with the possibility that he might be gay, which everybody else is asking about.
That's very strange why Tennessee Williams wrote that, because of all the characters in the play, you'd think that Big Daddy, as a sort of a southern kind of redneck, kind of brutal, you know, vulgar, brutal man, There's an extraordinary line where he says, one thing you can grow on a big place, more important than cotton, is tolerance. And that just comes out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And that's an understanding of how do you know that? And I think because he's lived. He said he bummed around when he was young. He sees things going on. But his real feeling is about being true to what you feel. Whatever that is, it's about the truth. He keeps looking for the truth.
He also mentions that he took over the plantation from two men who seemed to have a physical relationship
together, like two men. And he saw that and he said, well, that's... But then what he must have seen in that was a love and a connection, a true connection, and understood that as a human bond. It's the humanity that Williams writes about that's very, very surprising and very deep, actually.
Now, I mentioned that Williams always said that he considered Brooke to be heterosexual, but in developing the character for yourself, did you have to think that through and figure out where you feel he is?
Absolutely. I mean, unless you make a choice as an actor, I don't know that you can speak the words. But I am hesitant to say. It's like a magician telling you how he saw the woman in half. It kind of robs you of the joy of deciding for yourself.
Well, it's the last lines of the play when she says, "I love you, Brooke. I do love you." And he says, "Wouldn't that be funny if that was true?"
Yeah.
And you don't know.
That ambiguity is where the joy of the play lives, and people are so uncomfortable with that. They want to know the answer: are they going to make a baby? Are they? But the fact that you're asking those questions—that's the point. And as soon as you have a solid answer, the fun disappears.
Yeah, tied up with a bow. But in fact, if they're still wondering, it means they've been on a journey with the two souls.
With human beings in the context. Otherwise, go watch reality TV. They'll tie it up nicely for you.
Yeah.
The action takes place on the evening of Big Daddy Pollitt's 65th birthday. Why is that occasion so significant?
Well, I don't know, actually.
I do. Okay, I think it's because everyone else knows this is your last birthday. That's why everyone is banding together. Everyone is there, and
make it a big major celebration.
Exactly. We're gonna blow it out
with a bang.
That'll be that.
And everybody is positioning themselves for what's going to happen after Big Daddy dies.
Yeah, and the fact that there is no will made, so everybody's strategically trying to put them into a place where it needs to be sorted out.
And Brick is not going to be leaving an heir.
No. And Brick doesn't care to inherit it until he has a conversation with his father.
But he does also say that when he says, we've got to sort this out, and then he finds out that the Big Daddy asks him, the problem is you don't care. And he says, nope, I don't care. And that's brutal.
The two of them share a line. Wouldn't it be funny if that was true? What do you think that means?
I think... Because Big Daddy says it to Big Mama, and she says, "I loved you, always loved you." He said, "Wouldn't it be funny if that was true?" I mean, it's like, who's fooling who? You believe you love me? You want to believe that you love me? Do you really love me? Because if you really love me, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing right now. For example, the interpretation of it. And it's strange because that ending that then Brick says to Maggie at the very end, when Ben says, she says the same, "I love you, I do love you, Brick." And he says, "Wouldn't it be funny if that were true?" But it's a different. It's in a different place. It's spoken by a different person, but a father and a son, and yet it has different connotations. Because there's hope in that one.
Yeah.
And there's no hope in Big Daddy's version to Big Mama.
But I do think...
Well, Big Daddy says he's going to go out and have sex with a lot of different women now.
Yeah. Right. And he hasn't stood her for 40 years. And all that. It's kind of brutal.
Yeah. But it doesn't... It's like you were saying earlier, it touches upon the humanity, the inability of humans to communicate affection to each other. That even in a moment where someone has said so clearly and honestly that they adore you and love you, the inability to receive it on some level, that is part of the human condition.
Yeah, probably more male than female, I imagine.
Probably.
Yeah.
But it must have really come across as shocking when it was first produced, because some of these ideas, which we are now just part of the way we see the world, were probably a bit radical at the time.
Sure. And I think that's – and because it was hits so close to home for the human condition. That's why it holds up and why there can be so many different interpretations of the play and why we continue to come back to it.
So what's next for the two of you after Scarlett goes into a movie? You've done both. Done a lot of films, Kieran.
Yeah, I'll be out with my sandwich board again. Actor for hire.
Actor for hire.
Walking down somewhere sad in Dublin or London.
Do you like working here?
I do. I actually do very much. And this is the third time I've worked in New York on a play. And I just love it. And it's always been through the winter, so it's kind of bracing. But you're very much embraced by a community of people who work here in New York.
Well, one of the cliche questions, normally I avoid asking it, but people are curious about it, is, are audiences different here than they are? Well, you've worked in Ireland, in Scotland, and in London.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, there's a bit of whooping goes on sometimes when people have had a good time,
mm-hmm.
which you don't usually get from an English perspective.
Well, there are a lot of comedy lines here, and you wouldn't expect that many less. But the audience gets all of the jokes, doesn't it?
They come from underneath. They just arrive. I mean, it is brilliant because the stuff, the material is so on the nail. The passion, the drive, the war that's going on, and then suddenly from underneath comes this. What do you call it? I call it a bon mot, the little flicker of humor and bile at the same time, which seems to tickle a lot of people.
Yeah, they appreciate the irony or how uncomfortable it is. There's that great line at the end of Act One that Scarlett has. Brick says, I can't stand you, and how are you going to have a child with a man that can't stand you? And she says, well, I'll just have to figure that out. And it elicits, yes, laughter, yeah. That moment of true horror in a relationship revealed, and people just love it.
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is currently at the Richard Rogers Theater on West 46th Street, starring Scarlett Johansson and my two guests, Benjamin Walker and Karen Hines. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. Thank you.